So Connor Drake, welcome to the show. Film student, independent freelance filmmaker. We were talking a little bit offline, live streaming. That's like a big thing I'm into is live streaming. And Stevenson University, I checked out your sites, your Vimeo, some of your work. So tell me a little bit more about Connor Drake, who you are, what you do, what you've been up to.
So I am going to be a senior this year, graduating 2022. Film student, kind of cinematography editing track. So I love my camera work. I love editing. Right now I'm doing a lot of freelance, like live streaming work. I think pretty much everybody is right now. It's kind of where all the money is.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, if you can get into it, it's definitely a good thing to get into, but I'm really hoping to, after I graduate, kind of transition into being a first AC. Like, I love pulling focus. It's most of the work that I do on like capstone films and that kind of stuff. So that's really kind of who I am.
Awesome. Pulling focus. So what, why that? Like, for lack of a better, you know, like what, because I've seen it in movies, you know, that's something that I've always, and I realize how difficult that it is, but that always kind of captures like a cool moment. Is that?
Yeah, that, so for me, it just like, I really like working in high pressure environments. Like I used to work in Starbucks and other customers. It was like the perfect job because there was always something to do. And I think, you know, being first AC is really similar to that, where you show up and you have to be 100% on your game for every single minute you're on set. And, you know, being able to pull that like perfect sharp focus on a dolly shot, or even if it's just like, you know, somebody's sitting back and forth, it feels really good to get that done. And it scratches this like little OCD part of my brain. And so I love it. Mm-hmm. It's the most fun I can have on set.
The remote, is it the remote one?
Well, yeah, I purchased, like I've worked with the you know, old school, like follow focus that's right there on the lens for a while. And then I purchased a Nucleus Nano. And that was this like huge upgrade to being able to be, you know, off the camera on a separate monitor. And you can, you know, just have your eyes on that. And it's a huge difference in like the quality of work that I can do, I think.
Yeah. Like I've seen people doing it, and I've seen the shots that came out, you know, they look great. They look like those, you know, incredible, you know, racked focus, pulled focus shots. But I mean, it's intense. I just watched the extended version of Hateful Eight on Netflix. And, you know, as he got into, as they got into the diner and they were playing with the space inside, the haberdashery, the diner or whatever that place, the haberdashery. They were really playing with pulled focus and rack focus shots. And I thought it was really interesting what he was choosing to do that onto, you know what I'm saying? So
it's a great way, you know, you always hear like show don't tell, and especially with like films and shows, you want to communicate visually. And so having that, like, you know, you do that super fast rack focus from, you know, somebody looking at something that's then in the foreground, like all of those moments can really ramp up the emotion in a piece. And so it's a cool thing to be able to do. And I really like working with people that think that way, which you know, I don't have a lot of experience with that just because I'm not in like the real world yet. I'm working with a lot of students. And so being able to, you know, come onto a set and then maybe suggest to a director or a cinematographer, like, hey, here's a moment where we can use that rack focus to really accentuate what you're going for here is always it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. So how have you been? So, you know, considering the last year, you know, the quarantine and the pandemic and the lockdown and what have you, is most of the live streaming you've been doing, the virtual live streaming?
Okay. It's mostly live streaming, yet like virtually, because right when the pandemic started, I had an internship at Focal Point Productions with a dude named Marty Jenoff, who is a great guy. And he has this live streaming business that was pre-COVID, and then COVID hit and it really took off. And so I interned for him at the perfect time. And then once my internship was over, he brought me back. And it's mainly like live streaming, you know, off a TriCaster. So you're bringing people in on Skype or on Zoom, maybe one or two people in studio, and then pushing that out to like Facebook or YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. I spent most of like the last 5-6 years. That was a big gig of mine, was the live streaming on location. Every once in a while, maybe with a TriCaster, but I was using Wirecast a lot. And then every once in a while, you might have somebody remote bringing them into Skype. And then during quarantine, it flipped. Everybody was, you know, brought in with Zoom and still using Wirecast. And it was a lot of, you know, that was pretty much April to April for me. And then as things started opening up and as people started getting vaccinated, now I'm on a gig out of state. But yeah, I mean, the remote live stream, virtual remote live stream conferences, conventions, webinars, seminars, meetings, testimonials, all that stuff. Yeah, that was pretty much my whole 2020, essentially.
Well, no, I think it's really interesting to kind of watch how all of these, you know, companies and conferences are now used to the live stream. And so even if they're having their in-person events, they're going to be making it a hybrid event. And that's now a lot of the work is like, we're having our in-person event, but show up with like an A10 mini, mm-hmm. 3 or 4 cameras, and then they can get the best of both worlds. And it's, I don't think that's going to go away post COVID. That's still going to be a lot of the work for a lot of people.
Yeah. How else, you know, were you impacted personally, professionally, you know, over the last year?
I mean, I think, well, like on the personal side of things, I'm a military kid. And so like, you know, all of my family lives on the West Coast and my mom is immunocompromised. So as soon as COVID hit, it was like, I wasn't able to travel home for about a year and a half. I just saw my parents for the first time in about 15 months, mm-hmm. a couple of weeks ago when I went back to visit. And that was obviously super hard. You know, I'm close to my family. And so not being able to go back for Thanksgiving and Christmas really sucked. But, you know, on the other hand, professionally for me, it was actually an opportunity. That's the internship that I already mentioned. And then having set suddenly need COVID compliance PAs, because that was a job where, you know, I could take like a 30-minute online certification course and then have a very marketable skill to be able to get on sets and network with people in this role that did not exist a couple of months ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did the COVID compliance officer cert, never used it once. And I guess it helps to have that knowledge, because now I am on set as an AD, and that's, I guess, we are being compliant to the extent that we need to be, but it's you know, the reins have loosened a little bit on the whole COVID thing now, which is, you know, which is great. And we're able to, you know, kind of go back to the old normal way of doing things on set. But have you been back on set? Have you been back on out on the field, back out on location? You mentioned you did visit the family. You finally have visited the family.
Yeah, that's we've gotten vaccinated. And so that was, you know, I felt comfortable flying in a plane and it was like all good to go visit them. And then I did like during kind of peak COVID, which was like January of this year, you know, the very beginning of the year, I was on a lot of capstone sets. And that was all, you know, everybody's getting tested 2 or 3 days before the set happens. And then you're just expected to kind of sit in your apartment and not see anybody until that happens. But that's, you know, it was unexpected. It wasn't something I signed up for. But all things considered, it wasn't that hard. You know, I got lucky. We didn't have any sets with an outbreak. We didn't have, you know, nobody I knew caught it badly. And so, you know, I just feel like I got really lucky in that it didn't negatively affect me a lot. Whereas I feel like some people really had it just, you know, wreck their business and their way of making a livelihood. So.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that did happen for a lot of folks. That did happen. And, you know, in January myself, I got it. My wife got it. My 11-month-old got it. He's a year and a half old now. And I got it probably a day or two after I got my first shot, And so, you know, I guess that helps the vaccine skeptics argue that the shot gave you the COVID. And I'm like, no, somebody gave me COVID just at that perfect timing. That's what happened. Because and so she got it, the white and the kid got it. And as far as being wrecked, you know, because of my skill set, and she's a third grade teacher, she was, you know, virtual teaching. So financially we were okay, and professionally we were okay. But as far as being wrecked, I mean, that was probably the worst 3 days of my life. Because the kid, you know, he couldn't say I'm achy, or, you know, what were the other ones? He couldn't say I lost my sense of taste or smell. I experienced every single symptom that they had. I experienced it. Lost the loss of taste and smell was probably the biggest mind fuck of my life. And I lost weight because it's like, she was saying, you shouldn't be drinking if you're on COVID. And I'm like, you know, people are drinking all the time. And then the second I lose the sense of taste, I'm like, yeah, you're right. I'll stop drinking because there's no point if I can't enjoy, you know, my high octane, my high pricey beers or whatever. But, you know, for him, you know, he was going through a fever, at a pretty high fever for, I think, 2 days, diarrhea for three. So that's how we knew. But as far as his attitude towards everything, he was just as chipper and just as, he seemed just as happy and chipper and positive. But, and I must be a bitch because I think all she got was a headache and exhaustion. So she slept it off a couple of days.
But yeah, it hits people different ways. And like, so did the vaccine, because that was, I had, like, after my second shot, probably like 6 hours of like chills and aches, and I couldn't stand up straight. And then my dad, who also got it, he was like throwing up for like 2 days afterwards, where he just couldn't keep anything down. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, it's much better to have it than not to have it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, after I got the first shot, I had contracted COVID, but the second shot, I just dealt with exhaustion. That was it. She dealt with exhaustion after the first shot. I don't even think she even experienced anything after the second shot. So she must have a stronger immune system than me. But yeah, I mean, back on set. So yeah, but going back to, you know, tell me about an event, a gig, a film you've been back on since, you know, we've opened everything up.
Well, that's, I think, for me, kind of the really busy time was like the first 2 weeks of June, where I worked 16 days straight because of graduations and Memorial Day. And that was really the first time like being back in person. And it is a really weird feeling, you know, to be back and a bunch of people aren't wearing masks and you're there watching, you know, hugs and handshakes happen. And it is like, it's a surreal feeling. Yeah, because it is, you know, there's the whole discussion of like the new normal. And in some ways, a lot of stuff has changed. But, you know, I feel like people are kind of getting back to the pre-COVID way of doing things. And that's, it's a good thing, and I'm glad we can be there.
Yeah, you know, on this set, everyone's vetted, fully vaccinated. You had to be to work this gig. Yeah, that was their stipulation. And it's hugs, it's handshakes, inside and out, no mask, buffets and barbecues. When we do every once in a while. And it's a great feeling, and to be productive again, like we were, you know, 2 years ago and before that. But it's great to be productive, and to be, it's great to be productive. It's great to be productive in person with a group, with a team, hands on together. You know,
it's a very different feeling.
Virtual, you know, the remote virtual live streaming stuff was great. We were still getting the content. We were still bonding with people, whether it's like you and I are bonding now on this show, but there's nothing beats like that old normal of being on a set, being hands-on, you know, fist bumping, sharing script notes, you know, two or three people, four people pushing a dolly and a camera and pulling focus all at once. You know, the nothing beats that. So, I mean,
one of my favorite things about being, you know, about making films is being on a set with people where, you know, you're 8 to 12 people and you're going to spend the next month and a half working on something together. And so you have no choice but to get to know each other. And that is why it's so important to not just have like people that can do the job, but people that you enjoy being with, that even when you're cranky and you've been working for 12 hours and you haven't eaten enough that day and everybody's kind of pissed off, that you can still have fun and just focus on doing the best work. Yeah.
12 hours, haven't eaten enough. No. Yeah. And it's like, I'm 41 now, and now coming back to 12 hours, haven't eaten enough. And I was like, oh my God, some days I wish I'd rather just be back in my basement doing the remote virtual stuff, you know, for maybe 4 to 6 hours, and then go to the next room and play with the kids for another 4 to 6 hours. And that'd be my 12 hour day. You know what I'm saying? But it's great. It's great to be, you know, back out at it. What's next on your agenda for Connor Drake? What's next on the agenda, the next set of goals, the next set of plans? Obviously you're senior, so yeah. to graduate, obviously, you know.
Yeah, but one more year.
But I mean, what else? What's the branding, or what's the you know, what's some of the ideas? What's your passion project? What the next agenda?
For me, I think my next big thing is I'm trying to make a really solid capstone film. And that is, you know, I feel like a lot of people kind of treat a capstone film like any other project. So it's like, yeah, whatever, it'll come together when it comes together, blah, blah, blah. And I'm really, you know, I'm trying to have my script done by the time our semester starts. Mm-hmm. And that way I can really focus on my pre-production, because you cannot prep too much for a film. Like yeah.
You can't. I don't think you can over prep, but I think you can spend too much time. Eventually you gotta pull a trigger.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't, I have to agree mostly that, yeah, you can't over prep, because the more prep, the more backup plans you have, and the more notes that you have for leeway of this, that, and the other thing. And yeah, but
you've got to know what you want. You don't necessarily have to know exactly what you're doing on set, but the more you know what you want to get out of it, the less time you're going to spend, you know, trying to figure out like, oh, how many shots do I need here? Like, oh, do I need another shot here? Because if you know, like, hey, here's my shot list, here's the vibe I'm going for, I already have it planned out, I have my actors that I've rehearsed with, we know what we're doing, you can really get on set and, you know, pump out 40 shots in a day. Whereas people that maybe haven't planned are going to be doing 10 to 15. And that's, to me,
And those are the people that are like, oh, you know what we should do? And I'm like, bro, no.
Yeah.
Like, at this point, you gave me no storyboards, you gave me no shot list. And no offense to you as a film student, we're going back to fucking film school. It's going to be wide shot, medium shot, two shot, close.
What that is like, it's crazy how I've worked on some capstones where they made like a 5-minute film in 12 days and it was horrible. Mm-hmm. And then you have other people that make like a 10 to 12 minute well put together film that like there's good pacing and they push through and they shot that in 2 or 3 days. Mm-hmm. And the difference is the prep and having good people and knowing what you want.
And knowing what you want.
Yeah, you need to know what vibe you're going for. If you're doing a genre, do that genre. Don't like futz around with being 8 different things.
And it's almost a sacrifice to say, this is the direction I'm going. Mm-hmm. It's almost a sacrifice that you have to make. You have to make that decision. Oh, maybe we'll just shoot 17 different alternate endings and test them all out. And it's like, no,
yeah,
you have to make that decision. Mm-hmm. You have to, you know, put your, you have to put a pin in that. And that's almost a sacrifice to say, this is the end all be all for this film. This is the decision we're making.
Well, that is, there's this piece of reading that I had to do for a class last semester that had this phrase in it that kind of stuck with me. And it's like, directing is violence, because you're choosing to cut off all of your other options. Every mm-hmm. time you make a decision, you're going, all of this other stuff, we don't need it, get rid of it. And we're going to do our one choice. And that's, you just have to keep making choices and push through and trust that you're right. And you're going to have something in the end, because the more you like pussyfoot around it, and the more you, you know, try to make everybody happy, the less you're going to have like a clean, clear product.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you keep saying capstone film. So explain what that is, capstone.
So that is at Stevenson, you have the option to like direct a film essentially to end your 4 years.
Okay.
So you could also like shoot other people's, you can edit, you can, you know, do any number of roles, but I would like to try my hand at directing. And, you know, it's film school, like the stakes are low for as much as like, oh, it matters and all that. It's not like I'm going to change the world with this. I'm just trying to have fun and, you know, have a really good like piece to put on my resume to be like, hey, this is like what I want to make. And that's really what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I went to Towson. And so capstone film, I guess, in other words, a thesis film.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Essentially. So yeah, you know, like with Towson, there's three courses, film one, film two, and film three. And film three is essentially your thesis film. And there were a lot of hotheads. There were a lot of egos, big egos by the time you get to film three, and everybody has their script. And then eventually, you know, it's agreed upon to do this one script. And I had one and people shot it down. They said, you know, this would be too much. And then taking a look at a lot of the other ones, it turned out, no, it wasn't. That wasn't. We could have, had we done my script, this would have been so much, it would have come out better. Yeah. Because then I did mine the following summer. I'm thinking of a different script. No, that would have been pretty heavy. That would have been a pretty heavy short film. But now thinking back. So film two, I had submitted a script, and the same couple of the egos that ended up in film three shot down my film two script. And I said, okay, so I think for film two, I acted in something terrible. And then, and I mostly edited. So like you were saying, you know, you can partake on some of these capstone films. So in film two, I edited a couple of, or co-edited a couple of people's films. And then that summer did my short, relatively inexpensive on video, on DV. Back in that day, it was mini DV. We were switching from film to mini DV. With some color correction, you know, kind of like artsy it up a little bit. And that short came out great. Did as an independent study, and it was relatively well received. So then film three comes, and that's when I had a much heavier script. And they said, no, we got these ideas. And so I said, listen, I'm not doing enough if I'm just going to be working on this one film. So I chose to do sound design, sound production, sound design, and sound mixing on all five of everyone's,
wow,
okay, you know, final film, capstone film, thesis film. That's what I chose to do, because as each semester progressed throughout the 4 years, five years I did at Towson, 1 year was editing, 1 year was shooting, 1 year was, and then this year ended up being sound. I think another year was shooting, editing, sound. You know, I did a couple of directing projects, did a couple of, you know, what I directed, I had written. I acted a couple of times. And what what I found is that if you're, you know, there's this saying, if you're a jack of all trades, you're a master of none. But if you're a jack of all trades, you will become a master of one or two, because understanding sound, understanding editing, understanding shots, depth of field, space, set design.
Well, it's one of those things where, like, you know, you can see film in kind of two major different ways, where you either see it as a bunch of separate jobs, or you just see it as knowing how to be good on set. And that is, like, I've always tried, I will take any role if it'll get me on a set. Like, I've ran sound, I've, you know, gripped and gaffed, I've been an AC, I've been an AD, and it's all about getting on set, because the more time you spend on set, the better you're going to be at making films. Because you just learn, you learn the energy, you learn your rhythms, you learn how to get more done in less time. And that is what really counts. And, you know, editing, your post-production, the more post-production you do, the more you learn how to make it easier on set, because you can tell when somebody is shooting a film that doesn't know how to edit, or that has never edited something before. You know, they're the people that are like, oh, we don't need a slate here, just start rolling, like, what does it matter, da 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 da, and then you're making your editor's life 1,000 times more difficult in post.
Yeah, and you touched on a great point, is set life and how to be on set. Because starting in 2015, you know, I've been full-time freelance probably 15 years now, but I started acting back in 2015, took my military experience as an MP, law enforcement roles, military roles. And to fill in that schedule, of course, I want to write, direct, produce, AD, production coordinator, but I started applying to acting roles, mostly those kind of characters, detectives, cops, military, whatever, just to like fill in the schedule, but I'm still on set. And I know how to play those characters. I know my strengths as far as an actor. You know, for me as an actor, it's memorize your lines, be comfortable in front of the camera, and connect with the character. And that's it for me as far as acting. And I know my strengths, so that's why it's those roles. But as I'm on set, I'm studying from other directors, seeing how they direct, and they delegate everything to everybody else. Really, they have that vision. They communicate that vision, and it's delegated to everybody else. And as far as I'll be on set, and I've been doing this for a while, both behind and in front of the camera. And you got actors, local actors, that are like, "Oh, I gotta sit here in the green room," and I'm like, "Dude, chill, man." Like, you were told in the email, I already know it by heart, but you were told in the email, bring a book, bring a laptop, you know, bring a phone, bring a pad, bring some sort of entertainment with headphones. And every time I'm in the green room, I'm on the laptop trying to book 40 other gigs. Or on the laptop, there's some projects that I can edit that don't render that much. And I'm on the laptop, I'm editing something else, or I'm writing something else. Or I'm reading a book, like an ebook on my phone or my pad, or I'm just watching freaking YouTube while waiting. And you sit there and you wait to get called. I've already done the prep as far as, you know, knowing my lines, or knowing if it's, you know, some of these crime shows, they're all improv, but I know the situation. I know the scenes that are coming up. And really, half the time with some of these roles, they're well paying. You get a lot of screen time, but with the improv and sort of the situation that it is, all you have to do is show up.
Yeah.
And don't complain, because that's going to get back to these freaking, it'll get back to the production coordinators and the ADs. It'll get back to the producers and the directors, which will get back to the casting director, and they will put a red mark next to your name. And well, so when
I think the whole like show up and don't complain, it doesn't matter if you're an actor or, you know, whatever set you have on or whatever role you have on set, show up and don't complain is really important. It's just like, look, everybody here's in the same situation. Everybody here's got to wait for a while. So, you know, have a good attitude. Like, you can, I've found there's like two ways to complain, where you can complain in a fun way where you're like, oh man, it's cold out here, and you're like bantering with people like, damn, I can't believe the weather. And then there's the complaining in just the most annoying way where you expect like somebody to change something. And it's like, none of us have control over this. We're all here, part of the same show. Let's just, you know, knuckle up and deal with it. Because it's, now,
I mean, you're you know, considering you're a senior, but you've already been a professional and you're not really a student, but anymore. But when you were a student, what documentaries did they show you? Did they show you Heart of Darkness? And did they show you, you know, the stereotypical filmmaking documentaries, Heart of Darkness, or anything like that?
I mean, we, like, our documentary stuff was mostly from like a historical perspective, but I also, I'm a bad film student in that I don't watch a ton of movies. Like I watch what I like, but you know, there are people that really watch the movies they feel they have to so that they can have an opinion on it. Mm-hmm. And that is really the opposite of me. I watch what I like, and
I'm because interested. You want to make what you like.
Yeah, I want to make what I like. And that is the thing. It's like if I'm working with a director and they have a certain vision in mind, I will watch films with them or films that they recommend. It's like, hey, this is the tone I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. And it knows I'll go into and I'll dissect for the sake of doing the work that the director wants.
Well, yeah. That's the gig. That's the research for the gig. Yeah. Yeah. But, and I couldn't agree more. That's the research for the gig. Whereas Michael Bay, you know, was criticized for his movies. And he goes, those are the movies I like. Those are the movies I grew up with. I like explosions. I like hot, sexy ladies. I like, you know, shootouts. I like car chases. Those are the movies I make because those are the movies I like. I make movies for a 15-year-old boy. I make movies for a 15-year-old boy because those were the movies I watched when I was a 15-year-old boy that I liked.
Yeah, and like, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Right. Like, some people get really intellectual and kind of elitist about film, and I'm like, look, if what you want to do is show up and have fun, if what you want to do is like make something super scary, do that and do it the best you can, because that's, you know, that's the movie you want to make. You'll be able to make it really well.
Yeah, and you know, Chris Gore was just on. There's a YouTube channel, Film Folk. It's called Film Focus or something. But if you were to look up Chris Gore talking about fun, you'll find this interview. And he's saying, what happened to the fun? When the first Star Wars was made, there was only one box for them to check. Fun. Mm-hmm. And the reason why... Rise of the Skywalker, The Last Jedi, The Force Awakens might not have impacted us like the first and second and third Star Wars did, because now the studios have like all these boxes to check, merchandisable characters, box office sales, date of release for box office sales.
I feel like it's as much, you know, because you can look at like Marvel films, for example. Mm-hmm. And those are the same way, where they're like made by committee, but they're still fun to watch.
They're,
and like,
still fun.
It's like going into a roller coaster. And I feel like the difference there is you have that person that is controlling and planning, where, you know, you have your Kevin Feige in the Marvel universe who is making sure everything is going in the direction it needs to. Mm-hmm. Whereas with the new Star Wars, you just didn't have that overarching like theme and plan to get through all three movies.
There was you know, because George Lucas got out of it.
Yeah.
And some people were happy about that because of the prequel trilogy. But even looking back to episode one, as ridiculous as it was, and as terrible as it was received, that was more fun than I'd say some of the ones that followed episode one, as far as data release, as far as data production. But with George Lucas out, who's the Kevin Feige of the Star Wars? Kevin Feige has been doing Marvel movies since, I think Kevin Feige was on X-Men 1 in 2000. And he knows the characters. He knows the comics. He knows the entire...
It's about having that, like, yeah. The
connection,
the ethos, and like the theme of the universe as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, you know, something that some people complain about is like, you go to see a Marvel movie and you're gonna get the same feelings from most of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, but that's the point. And, you know, it just kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier with the, you have to know what you want. And I think, you know, Feige does know exactly what he wants out of his Marvel movies. And even when you mix it up with like a Guardians of the Galaxy or like, you know, a Captain America Winter Soldier, where it's really different from maybe like your first Iron Man, it's still at the end of the day is pushing towards that same point and the same kind of like emotional catharsis that you're getting from all of the films.
Yeah.
So whether or not it's like cinema, you know, you have the whole Scorsese comparing them to like roller coaster rides. It might not be fine art, but it is.
But roller coaster rides are fun as hell.
Yes.
And you have a lot of people lying to ride roller coasters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And going back to the complaining, you know, and well, go and also, you know, this also touches upon you know, movies that you like. You know, when I was a student, they were showing documentaries like Heart of Darkness. You know, they were showing some retrospective pieces about Lynch or Soderbergh, but From Dusk Till Dawn, Tarantino and George Clooney, Robert Rodriguez's From Dusk Till Dawn, had a documentary come along with the DVD set. I think the documentary is now on Netflix, called Full Tilt Boogie. Mm-hmm. And it's a documentary about that making. And the difference between this documentary and Heart of Darkness is Heart of Darkness only followed Coppola in making Apocalypse Now. And it's a good documentary. And it's a good study on what a director had to go through to finish his piece. But Full Tilt Boogie is for just about everybody, from the director to the PA. It's talked to everybody. What are you going through? What are you dealing with? It went through SAG and DGA union issues. It went through ACE issues as well. And that is probably the best documentary as far as watching a film being completed. Mm-hmm. from script to screen.
That's kind of like the Lord of the Rings behind the scenes, where they're just so in depth and you can really get like a feeling for the process and for all of the people involved.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, I you know, before I knew I wanted to be a filmmaker, I remember watching those behind the scenes and just going, that looks like the best job you could have.
Yeah.
Because it really is, there's some magical about being on set and about making movies that you just can't take away from. Yeah, it's great.
And Full Tilt Boogie has that too. You know, they're at this motel in the desert, I guess, of New Mexico or Arizona, wherever they shot it, Colorado. They're at some, it's that stereotypical desert motel. And they're, you know, at night they're in the hot tub drinking beers. Then they get hit with a sandstorm and they got to shut down the set. And, you know, a couple of guys were like locked up in this trailer and they're like playing the guitar, singing songs. They're doing rain dances outside to like make the rain go away and stop, because I think they had one freaking shot left for the day. And so that's where Full Tilt Boogie. But what stood out for me was some very simplistic remarks by Michael Parks. Now, Michael Parks was the sheriff that got shot in From Dusk Till Dawn. Michael Parks was, he was also the sheriff like that came back to life, I guess, based on the continuity of Kill Bill. And he was in Planet Terror. Michael Parks, I don't know if you ever seen Tusk. He was the weirdo that wanted to make him, turn him into a Tusk. So Michael Parks is the sheriff who was killed in From Dusk Till Dawn. So the actor is talking to the camera and he's, you know, like, I would do radio if it paid well.
Yeah.
You know what? You're on set. You're making a movie. This is fun. You know, you got so many complainers. Oh, the chicken breast is dry and cold. And he looks at the camera and goes, compared to the filet mignon you have every night. Like, and that just clicked to me, like, yeah, man, like, embrace this suck, because you just, because the funner, the more fun, the more exciting things that are happening within the moment of the production. Yeah. And then you see the final product and hopefully it's good. And usually it is. And you're just like, yeah, man, I remember shooting that shot. It was what a crazy week it was doing that scene, doing that movie, whatever. You forget about the dry.
It goes back to like there's a saying that we have in my family, which is bad days make good stories. And oh, so okay. That, you know, if you have a real shitty day and you just, life keeps hitting you while you're down, in a month, you'll be able to tell that story and laugh.
Yes.
And that is, you know, I've had horrible days on set where it's cold and it's windy. And for some reason, you know, the Tascam just refuses to record and nobody can figure out what the hell's going on. But, you know, now I can go.
The fucking Tascam refuses to record.
Oh, man.
And it's funny you mention that, because like now, like, I can relate to that. And I don't know how much older I am than you, but the fucking Tascam refuses to record. And someone's like banging it, changing the batteries, turning it on and off again. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, so speaking of which, bad days make good stories, you know, just, you know, having fun shooting movies, what that you want to shoot, what drives you, what's your driving force? What drives you personally, professionally?
You know, I think, so this kind of goes back. I used to act like that is, you know, I was that stereotypical young teenager. I was convinced like, this is how I'm going to make it. And I remember like, I worked my ass off, you know, I went to a bunch of auditions and I was trying my best. I was working at Starbucks at the same time and I was getting on sets. And as I was on sets, I kind of started to realize that one, making a movie was a lot more than acting. And, you know, you might have two actors on a set, but you've got like 8 to 10 other people behind the camera. Mm-hmm. And so if I really wanted to do this, why wouldn't I make the jump to, you know, trying to do both or mainly focusing on behind the camera. And then at that same time, you know, I was working at Starbucks and realizing I am giving, you know, my all to this job and I hate every second of it. Like, yeah. I love the people I'm working with, but doing the actual work and dealing with customers is just soul sucking. And I was coming home every day, like, why the fuck am I doing this? And so, you know, it kind of clicked in my head. Like, I can work hard. I have it in me to work hard. And no matter where I go in my life, I'm going to end up working my hardest. Cause you know, here I am at a job I hate and I'm still willing to give it 12-hour days.
Yeah.
So why not put that energy behind something, you know, a pipe dream. And that is what working in film is, you know, for me and for so many other people, is it's this thing that seems impossible. But I know if I put my all behind it and I just work my ass off every day and I keep my head down, that I'll get there and, you know, I'll be able to make a living. I'm not going to be a millionaire, but I'm going to be able to have like a nice house. You know, I'm going to have enough to live. And that's, mm-hmm. I don't need a lot. All I need is, you know, a place to put my head down and enough to eat. And if I'm doing a job that makes me happy and I'm working on projects that can give me fulfillment, I've got nothing to complain about.
Yeah, man. Outstanding. I love it. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, just putting in work and doing something that you're proud of, but putting in work into something that you love. Yeah. And that's fun. Because
I've had... I feel like no matter what, you should be proud of the work you do. And that is something I don't think it matters what job you have. You should do it at a level that you can be proud of. And that's whether you're making espresso drinks, you know, you should be making the best damn latte you can. Yeah. Because you're there and you're getting paid for it. And you need to find some kind of reason to do it, you know, even because otherwise, you're just there for the money, and that is the quickest way to just have your soul sucked out of you. And so if you can really work hard and find pride in what you're doing, I think you can be happy. And if you find pride in something that you love, that I don't know any better way to live. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, man. digging that. I got no follow up. I mean, I
that I feel like I hear that from so many people that I work with on sets, where they're just like, yeah, I kind of realized I could work my ass off. And, you know, people that work hard are always in demand, and it doesn't matter what industry you're in. So if you have it in you to work hard, find something you love, and people will give you the opportunities to succeed.
Yeah. Outstanding. Outstanding. Connor Drake. I mean, I think that's it, man. Right. I mean, that's awesome. Well, look, I'm excited to see what comes from you and the live streaming, dude. Like, I like it because it's the new tech. I see it still going, you know, to much more vast arrays in live streaming and the podcasts and the virtual events and all that stuff. I mean, for me, it's just a big moneymaker. I like it. There's ways of being creative, and there's ways of being of experimenting with live streaming, and but I'm all about that, man. But as I look forward to seeing your capstone film, your thesis film, and Connor. So I'll don't go anywhere. We'll talk a little bit offline, and catch up.
And honorary member of the Zombie Squad, send me some, hit me up on any of the socials. Send me the name that you want to be credited as a honorary member of Zombie Squad. Send me your favorite one or two profile pictures, avatars, what have you, your profile pictures on Instagram, Facebook, whatever, and we can squad you up. I will make you an honorary member of the Zombie Squad, and I'll design all this stuff. I'll design a t-shirt, I'll design your logo, your whole Zombie Squad kind of profile, if you want to be an honorary member of Zombie Squad, and give you the options to buy a t-shirt, to buy a phone case, to buy a pillow, to buy a tapestry, to buy a hoodie, to whatever the hell you want. But if you want to be a honorary member of the Zombie Squad, let me know. And
they gotta put in the work though.
All they have to do is send me one or two of their profile pics, and they'll be an honorary member of the Zombie Squad.